From the History Yogi podcast, this is Dave. When we think about the history of Indians in British Malaya, their work in the rubber estates usually comes to mind first. But Indians also helped construct, operate, and maintain the Malayan railways that stretched across the peninsula and connected Singapore as well. Along with the tracks came numerous Hindu temples and shrines that shaped Malaya's religious landscape. Today, we speak to Professor Vinita Sinha from the National University of Singapore about her new book, Temple Tracks. We discuss the history of Indian labourers in the Malayan railways, their role in religion making via temple construction, and how these railway temple stories symbolise the contributions of Indians in developing colonial Malaya and independent Malaysia. So thanks very much, Prof. Vinita, for joining me today. To start off, what prompted you to explore this connection of Indian labour and Hindu temples with the railways in Malaya?
Thank you so much for having me on this blog. I'm very happy to talk about this issue. I guess the project really began with a seemingly simple empirical question, which is why were there so many Hindu shrines and temples along the railway tracks across Singapore and Malaysia? But it was really the density and proximity to railway premises that was striking to me. So I wondered, was this a mere coincidence, or what was the actual historical relationship of these temples with the railways? And most of all, I was very intrigued with the builders of these temples, right? And strikingly, these temples were still visible along the railway tracks in Singapore well until 2011, when the tracks actually began to be removed from across the island nation state. So ironically, the book was actually conceived in those moments when I watched the tracks being removed, which of course triggered historical memories about the people who had laid these tracks in the first place. So a kind of a predictable response to the puzzle of temples along the tracks pointed to the Hindu railway labor and personnel who had constructed these early places of worship. But of course, historical data also point to Sikh communities who had built gurdwaras along the railway tracks, as well as some Muslim personnel who had built mosques along the tracks as well. But of course, this is not really a surprise to us, because we know that the labor communities who were employed in ports, harbors, prisons, municipality, mining industry, and rubber plantations were actually, apart from being critical actors in colonial capitalist projects, also materialized the Hindu landscape and the religious landscape in the region. So I wanted to study this phenomenon because I wanted to actually focus the lens on the laborers who had sacralized these landscapes by building shrines and other places of worship for their deities who had journeyed with them to these new lands.
Could you briefly share with us the history of railway line construction in colonial Malaya?
Right. So as in other colonies, the pattern and railway networks in British Malaya were determined by the needs of colonial capitalism. And specifically in Malaya, they were determined by the sites of the tin mining industry and its needs. This was the very first impetus for building the railways in Malaya. And then subsequently, of course, the growth of the rubber plantation economy intensified the construction of a transportation network. And this was crucial in a geographical landscape of Malaya, which was dominated by rivers and waterways as traditional modes of transporting goods. So the building of a railway network and then roads were undertaken primarily to link the mines and plantations with the coastal ports. Interestingly, the railways came to Malaya before the road networks, and the railways were first integrated with the river launches well before roads were built, which functioned as feeder to the railways, basically. So the railway network grew slowly. In fact, the very first railway line in British Malaya was the Taiping Port Weld Railway Line, which was a mere 12 kilometers long and was constructed between the town of Taiping and Port Weld in 1885, right? So this was the earliest. And then subsequently, another early line, which opened in 1899, was the Prai Bukit Mertajam line in Province Wellesley in Penang. And this enabled the transportation of commodities such as river and tin towards the harbour. We know that the Federated Malay State Railways was a consolidated railway operator, which was established in 1901. So the FMSR purchased the Singapore Government Railways in 1913. And this was connected to the Thai railway system in 1918, partially actualizing the British dream of an interconnected pan-Asian railway network. So in 1923, Singapore was connected by causeway to the Malay Peninsula, and the Singapore station at Tanjung Pagar actually became a gateway to Malaya and Thailand by 1932. So in I think, less than 4 decades, the FMSR operated a total network of almost 1,700 kilometers along the west and east coasts of Malay Peninsula and in Singapore. So this was quite remarkable. Of course, the West Coast Line was built first, and it was built in sections to cater to the needs of the tin mining and the rubber plantation industries. And on the West Coast, the line ran from Singapore to Padang Besar on the Malaysian-Thai border. And then the East Coast Line, which is actually the lesser known of the network, was 526 kilometers. It's now known as the Jungle Railway. And this was a largely single track meter gauge, which ran from Gamas Railway Station in the state of Negeri Sembilan to the coastal town of Tumpat in Kelantan, also on the Thai-Malaysian border. So this stretch on the East Coast was functional in sections from as early as 1910, but was only completed in 1931. So really 1931-32 are the kind of definitive moments when the entire FMSR network was operational, and it was used for communication and for transporting goods, but strikingly also for transporting passengers, which was quite different in the Malayan context, because in many of the other colonies, the colonial railways were really primarily only built for transporting commodities and resources, and at best, some labor and some soldiers. But in Malaya, from very early on, the railways were actually transporting passengers in large numbers as well. So that's the network. And then, of course, the FMSR ran from 1901 to 1947. And then with the various sort of political changes, geopolitical changes that were taking place in the country, it was renamed. And during the Japanese occupation of British Malaya from 1941 to 1945, the entire network, railway network, was under Japanese control, of course. It was renamed Marae Tetsudo, and parts of the railway network suffered tremendous damage and disuse, with some of the branch lines and depots being closed. And of course, for the Japanese, they were interested not so much in the Malayan network, but they were interested in prioritizing the building of the Thai-Burma railway, for which they actually removed construction materials from the FMSR and also diverted is a polite word, railway employees and Tamil laborers from British Malaya in the service of this ambitious military project. I mean, this was a devastating project which destroyed not just the railway network, but also large numbers of Tamil laborers' lives who were kidnapped literally from Malaya and taken to work on the Thai-Burma railway network. So of course it recovered. Subsequently, the railway networks recovered after the war when the British returned. And between 1948 and 1960, the railway functioned as the Malayan Railways. And then with the nationalization of the railways in 62, we finally had the Kereta Api Tanah Melayu, the KTM, by which name it was known and is still known up to now.
What was the labor hierarchy like in the railways, and how were the housing and working conditions like for the lower tier of laborers?
Right. So this vast railway network was staffed by a huge labor force, but it was internally differentiated. And scholars like Amarjit Kaur, who have worked on this as a historian on the railway networks, have pointed out that this differentiation was also ethnically segmented, right? And also, of course, class stratification operated as well. So through the colonial period, the railway works saw employment of the indigenous Malays in small numbers, as well as Chinese, Javanese, and largely Indian immigrants in the railway networks. So Amarjit Kaur's research argues that there were basically three types of railway staff in the colonial period. So the managerial elite, which comprised mainly European staff who were paid on a monthly basis. Then you had the kind of subordinate technical and clerical staff, comprising mainly of the Jaffna Tamils, who were also paid on a monthly basis. And together, these two groups ran the railways, right? The last category were the railway workers. And this comprised a skilled workers, semi-skilled workers, and unskilled laborers. The skilled workers were largely the Chinese who were employed as mechanics and fitters and blacksmiths, electricians, etc. The semi-skilled workers were mainly Indians who were signalmen, lampmen, pointsmen, etc. But the unskilled laborers were predominantly from South India, and they are the ones who laid the tracks and maintained the tracks, right? So this third group was of railway employees paid on a daily basis, and they were housed in accommodation, which has been described as coolie lines, right? Labor lines, very often along the railway tracks themselves, as well as in the vicinity of the railway depots, stations, and workshops. So from very early on, the Indians were employed in very large numbers and dominated the railway workforce. But what's striking is that, as in the rest of the civil service in the colonies, there were differentiated benefits for different categories of railway workers, right? So housing, travel, wages, and health policies were different for British and non-British personnel. For example, only the British were allowed to travel in first-class carriages in India and in other British colonies. Of course, hypocritically, the British civil servants paid themselves more, ensured more hygienic and sanitary living conditions for themselves, and they enjoyed good housing and medical care. The lowest category of the railway's workforce, the unskilled laborers, were housed in what were called class 11 accommodation. So in urban locales, these translated into cement barracks with a hall and a bedroom and a kitchen with shared toilets and bathrooms. And they were typically located behind the outside and behind the lines. Each barrack housed 7 to 8 living units. And this was in the urban centers. The barracks and coolie lines along the tracks and the wayside stations were wooden barracks mainly, and they were without piped water, drainage, and electricity. So the manual workers living in these dismal conditions were vulnerable to the elements, natural disasters, and suffered from diseases and death. The coolie lines through the early decades of the 20th century were grim and dreary. They didn't have ventilation, did not mean sanitary standards. The housing conditions of the what were called the permanent way gangs who lived along the tracks in isolated terrains, these barracks were the least regulated accommodation and most neglected, barring occasional visits from healthcare workers and sanitary inspectors. So the people who laid the tracks and did the maintenance works were unskilled laborers who had the poorest working and living conditions.
Aside from railway infrastructure, your book also explores the role of religion making by these laborers via temple construction. So why did colonial authorities accommodate such religious activities, and how did you trace these temple stories?
So it seems ironic, but the British authorities had a rather liberal stance towards the building of places of worship in British Malaya, right? And this applies to all the immigrant communities. So we see the early presence of Chinese and Hindu temples, mosques and gurdwaras as examples of religious structures in British Malaya. The British did not discourage these expressions of religiosity, but in fact, they supported these through land grants and even sometimes paid for construction of these religious edifices. In the early years of the settlement, the authorities were willing to do all that was necessary to fill the island with inhabitants, right? I mean, this was one way of keeping people there. This was particularly the case with the Indian community because the Indian migrants actually didn't show particular enthusiasm for settling in British Malaya. So the incidence of Indian men who had come alone to work in the colonies going back to India was very common, and this pattern actually really didn't change until the 1950s. So one strong motivation for the British to encourage these building of these places of worship was inspired by the desire to appease migrant workers and provide an incentive for them to settle in the colony and therefore provide a ready labor force to serve the political economic needs of the colony. Interestingly, the British authorities also acceded to attend and participate in the religious ceremonies and festivals observed in these places of worship. So it was not uncommon to have members of the British civil service present at some of these religious events in temples, for example, like the festivals of Thaipu Sam and firewalking often saw the British present there. According to my interlocutors, they said that every year the British or the white men would give us a sack of rice, or on Diwali they would give us, or Deepavali they would give us a goat for sacrificing. And in these moments, the British momentarily sort of suspended their civilizing mission, which, as I said, had gained quite a lot of traction in the UK from the end of the 19th century. So the British authorities were benign and they allowed the natives to continue with their spiritual lives and ceremonies, even though they didn't approve of them. For as far as the railway workers were concerned, it's important to notice that the shrines and temples that dotted the length of the railway tracks were actually built by the laborers themselves. So the British allocated space and gave the builders of temples temporary occupation licenses, right? Giving them the right to occupy the land, and for which the laborers had to pay a monthly or an annual fee. It was a very small sum of money, but still they needed to secure a license for the right to build a temple on railway premises, right? So, and this is very different from the estate temples in Malaya, for example, because the estate temples were built by the plantation owners for the laborers, right? Whereas the railwaymen temples were built by the laborers themselves. And the contrast is quite palpable because in the estates, the owners themselves provided a kind of religious infrastructure for the laborers. But interestingly, in the estate, sometimes salaries of the laborers would contribute to the building of the temple. So they would deduct, the owners would actually deduct a small sum of money. But I think in sum, the British were basically, as I said, benign and tolerated these religious practices for purely instrumental strategic reasons. It was to keep the labor force happy. And they understood that religiosity was very important. I mean, the British had this experience in India as well. And so they brought this to the British Malayan context too.
And so how did you trace these temple stories?
So the temple stories were actually, so I started to do the research by traveling on the train, right? So I used the railway premises as coordinates for mapping the temples, because traveling on the road didn't give me the sort of perspective that I needed to map the temples, right? So the first sort of approach was to travel on the train itself. And fortunately, when I started doing the research, the trains on the West Coast were still running at 70 to 80 kilometers an hour. So I could actually see where the temples were, or the remnants of the temples were, along the railway tracks. So what I did was I traveled along the railway tracks first, and then I mapped the temples, and then I followed up by road, right? So the strategy was to map the temples from the train, then follow up by road, and then go to these temples and identify communities around the temples to generate social histories from them. So when I went to the temples, I was very fortunate to actually encounter a very willing pool of interlocutors who were more than happy to tell me the temple stories. And so that's where the idea of the stories comes, right? So initially, when I said to some of my interlocutors that I was interested in mapping or finding out about the history of the temples, most of them said, well, we don't know anything about the history because we were not there and we don't have any documents about the past. We have no evidence, etc. And they couldn't remember dates and things like that. But when I said to them that I was just interested in knowing about the stories of the temple, and I use the Tamil word Kovil Kadai, right, which means temple stories. When I use that expression, that seemed to resonate with people, and they were more than willing and able to tell me the stories of the temple. And so then they began to narrate when the temples were founded, who they thought were the founders of the temples, and of course their own genealogy and connection with the temples, right? So many of the people I spoke to were actually descendants of what I call railway families in the temples, right? So the stories were actually collected from people who ran the temples in the present, who had some kind of a connection with the founders of this temple in the past. And many of them came from railway families, meaning that their fathers, their grandfathers, uncles, brothers, cousins had been working in the railways across the Malayan landscape, right? I, of course, couldn't find these temple stories in the archives, in the official archives. They were not present there. But I did stumble into what I call private archives, which were kept in the temples themselves, right? So I would often be led to a small section of the temple where there would be an old trunk or something, right? And then they would open it and inside would be all these papers and documents. In fact, it is in these trunks that I discovered that the temple builders actually had to pay a temporary occupation license because they had kept these receipts, right, from the British times. And some of these receipts were like going back to, I think the earliest that I found went back to 1948 or something, right, from one of the temples where they had to pay a sum of a few dollars to the British, or actually more accurately to the FMSR, the Federated Malay State Railways, for the right to build a temple. And I sort of generated these temple stories by adopting biographical approach, right? So I asked people to tell me their life stories. And very often it was within the life stories that the temple stories were also embedded. So that's how the stories came about. And it was a very rich body of material for me.
Having researched the Hindu god Muniswaran previously, you now study his significance as a railway god. Why was Muniswaran such an important deity for the labourers? And could you also share about his railway temples in Singapore?
Right. So, of course, like other students of Hinduism in British Malaya, I had been very aware that the category of deities known as popular deities or small gods or non-Sanskritic deities were the ones that had been brought to British Malaya with the Indian migrants when they came, because the migrants who came from India were largely from the lowest rungs of the class and caste hierarchy. Of course, there were other categories as well, but predominantly from these categories. And so they brought their gods with them, and most of their gods were non-Sanskritic gods. And of course, Muniswaran was one such deity. He's known as a guardian deity in the Indian context, and he's a non-Sanskritic deity who was attended to by non-Brahmin ritual specialists and things like that. So we know this from the history of Hinduism in British Malaya, that this was the category of deities that came and these were the popular ones. In British Malaya, the two deities that have been very common from this category are, of course, the male guardian deities as well as the mother goddesses, right? So these were the two categories of deities. And Muniswaran is a very prominent sort of member of the male guardian deity. So in fact, in my earlier research on Hinduism in Singapore, I had encountered three or four Muniswaran temples that had been specifically associated with the railway. So maybe I'll answer that question first about the Singapore temple. So when I was a master's student and I was doing research on Hinduism, I actually came across three or four temples that were associated with Muniswaran. One was the Kampung Bahru Muniswaran temples, which was right at the start of the railway temples in Tanjung Pagar. Another one was, of course, the very famous Commonwealth Queenstown Muniswaran temple, which is still around today. And then also there was a temple along 7.5 miles along Bukit Timah Road, which was also a Muniswaran temple, which was very prominent because it had these two life-size figures of white horses that you could see from the road itself, right? And this was also built by railway laborers. So these were the three temples that I knew. But in my earlier work, I had never heard of Muniswaran being described as a deity for the railways, right? But in the current work, I consistently heard from my interlocutors that Muniswaran was a railway god. And this really compelled me to interrogate the relationship between the railways and the deity. And I felt that there was something more to this relationship and that I needed to go beyond the idea of a small god and a guardian deity. The one thing that became very clear to me in this leg of the research was that many of my interlocutors who were former railway laborers expressed an affinity between what they denoted as the small people, referring to themselves and manual laborers, and Muniswaran, whom they affectionately call Ayya. And they describe him as a simple man's god or an ordinary worker's god. And they observed that historically, the laborers who had built and maintained the railways could not go to the big temples, right, to the Sanskritic Agamic temples because of restrictions on temple entry, which operated in British Malaya well into the 1940s and 50s. It was only up after the the ban on temple entry was lifted in India, that the similar things happened in Singapore. So they were very aware that the laborers could not, from low caste backgrounds, could not go to the big temples and could not pray to the big gods because of their caste background. And so they had to build temples for their own gods, right? So this affinity the deity had with those from lower castes and class backgrounds is, of course, evidenced in the large numbers of temples that were built for Muneeswaran. A dominant sort of narrative about Muneeswaran that I heard this time around was this idea that the Muneeswaran temples were built by KTM laborers. And of course, they want to have Muneeswaran around their workplaces because they feel a sense of protection and safety, right? Which goes back to the idea of Muneeswaran as a guardian deity. But, you know, coming back to this idea of the railways and Muneeswaran, one of the features of Muneeswaran's identity, which is popular with devotees, is that he's free-spirited and he likes to roam and he doesn't like to be frozen and trapped in stillness in these big temples. So his devotees build temples for him in where under trees, on top of mountains, in jungles and in wide open natural spaces. And in the case of the railways, my interlocutors who built the temples and who were caring for the temples observed that the railway tracks and the surroundings areas were also sites favored by the deity, right? And they substantiated this by alluding to the rolling, unending features of the tracks themselves, which enabled the movement of trains and emphasized that mobility of all kinds was appealing to the deity, right? So devotees I spoke to explained that the constant movement of the trains was in perfect synchronization with the deity's desire to be on the move as well. And so they thought of him as a railway god. But of course, his identity as a guardian deity was also important because, as we know, railway work was dangerous. It was very demanding. It was hazardous and risk-laden. So clearing dense vegetation and trees and forests, doing earthwork, moving soil, stone and builders, laying tracks. I mean, these were all dangerous works, and we know that a lot of laborers actually lost their lives, and they were also hurt during, I mean, the number of accidents that took place during the construction and the maintenance of the railways were also very carefully documented by the British. So under these conditions, my interlocutors argued that given the presence and dangers of working on the railways, right, the need for protection from a guardian deity assumed a new relevance and resonance in British Malaya.
As the railways transition from colonial times to the post-independence era, the role of Indians in the workforce has also sharply declined. How has this evolution affected the railway temples in modern Malaysia?
Yeah, so let me return to the first thing I began with, this whole question of how many temples were there. So of course, we know that the railway landscape in Malaysia and Singapore has been dramatically reconfigured. Encounter with urban development, the modernization and electrification of the railways has really transformed the railway landscape. With that, all the surroundings have also been reconfigured. So the sacred landscapes which existed along the railway tracks have also been transformed. And so when I first started the research, I was moving up on the train northwards from Singapore and Johor, I did wonder how many of these temples would still be there for me to do research on, right? With the sort of Malayanization of the railways, which started as early as the 60s, but really escalated into the 70s and 80s, right? The earlier dominance of the Indians in the railways really began to decline, and many of them were retired at 55, when that used to be the retirement age, and they were not replaced and things like that. So both of these things happening together, right? I really wondered how many temples I was going to find. So at the end of my journeys on the West Coast and the East Coast, I was able to count and list 94 temples that were still marked as railway men temples and which functioned and existed, right? And they were not dead spaces, but they were animated and livened temples. And so that was quite encouraging to know that despite the modernization and the fact that religious sites, including other sites, had to make way for the modernization of the railways, that in fact, a sacred landscape persists, right? And this, of course, happens when the railways were being modernized, when people were being basically ejected from the railways, and there was a turn to mechanized methods of track maintenance. The Indian gang line workers were made redundant. They were no longer housed near the tracks. And so I thought the spaces alongside the new railway tracks would now be bare, marked by absences. There would be no temples, etc. But to my surprise, through the moments of railway infrastructure, the complex and layered processes of religion making in railway premises has been paradoxically renewed and refreshed. The old tracks have fallen into disuse and have been retired, but many of the temples along these tracks have persisted and have been energized, right? And one would have expected that the temples would be vulnerable, but in fact, it's ironic that the temples have shown relative longevity, some of which have even outlasted the hardware of the railway structures. Infrastructures which have been replaced by newer and more sophisticated technology. Some of them continue to be in the hands of railway families, and so they're sustained by the descendants of railway laborers. But many have, of course, moved into other hands. But these other communities that have taken over these once upon a time railway temples have found it meaningful to sustain the railway connection in their narratives of the temple stories, right? Of course, now it's very hard for them to build temples, new temples along the railway tracks, because the entire stretch from JB to Padang Besar on the West Coast has now been electrified, and they've put up fences to protect people. So a lot of the temples, which would have been earlier built on the inside of the next to the tracks, have now actually migrated to the outside. So it was very striking that even outside the fences that now exist, people are actually returning to the railway tracks as an efficacious site to build new temples, right? So you have this very complex kind of phenomenon where the older temples that were established 100 years ago are still there and are being maintained either by railway families or by others, right? Who remember the railway connection. And then you also have instances of people going back to sites, railway sites, where the temples used to be, if not the exact site, then in the vicinity somewhere, with the desire to establish new temples. So alongside older temples that have persisted, and many Hindus have this notion that once a site has been marked for worship, that even if the physical structure itself is removed, the site itself is animated and continues to be energized. And so it's not uncommon for people to return to places even when temples have disappeared.
Finally, your writing process was long and challenging. What stories or interviews would you say encouraged you to keep going during that time?
So this acknowledgement of the non-laboring lives of labor in this project was something that kept me going. And I thought one example of the non-laboring lives of labor is that to think of them as religion makers, right? So I think of railway laborers as pioneering religious makers in British Malaya, which allowed me to go beyond talking about their kind of laboring productive capacities in economic terms, right? And so in a colonial context of unequal power relations and hierarchies, railway labor communities were, of course, in a subjugated position and often disenfranchised, right? So for me, another way of retelling railway histories has been to acknowledge the humanity that remains obscured in mainstream narratives in railway construction. So the desire to surface this kind of underlying hidden but vital humanity in narrating railway histories was very inspiring. And for me, of course, this was an intellectual project, but it was also for me an ethical and political project, because I felt that the book can be a very small contribution to provide a space where the historical contributions of Indian labor in literally building Malaysia and Singapore can be made visible, right? And I wanted to find a way to privilege their perspectives, to recognize their everyday lives, to give some space to their voices, right? And so that was what kept me going. And I was also very inspired by hundreds of people I met along these journeys where, and I'm talking about the Indian laborers, right? So, or the former Indian laborers who built these temples, who still continue to be the caretakers. And I found that the large numbers of people that I spoke to in Malaysia themselves wanted to keep this recognition of the contributions of Indian labor to building Malaysia, right, in the forefront. Because as we know, some sections of the Indian Malaysian community still remain disenfranchised and live in very difficult and challenging conditions. They haven't experienced the kind of mobility that other sectors of the community have experienced. And so the people that I was talking to, I mean, the average age of the people that I talked to was about 70 years, right? And most of my interlocutors were Tamil men or Malayali men or Telugu men, some of them, right? And these were people who came from sort of middle-class backgrounds, some of them from lower middle-class backgrounds, and they were very committed to maintaining these remaining railway men temples, right? Because they felt a sense of solidarity and affinity with the temples and others who had built the temples. And so some of my interlocutors would say, when I asked them, like, why do you keep doing this? Because they had limited funding, they had few resources and a dwindling sort of community around the temple. And still these people would come back every day to buy things, to conduct the prayers, to organize festivals and things like that. And I asked them, what is it that keeps you going, not just maintaining old temples, but even wanting to build new temples around railway premises, right? And so one of my interlocutors said to me, and I quote, he said, we do this because we don't want our children to forget what our fathers and grandfathers did for the railways for this country. And we want them to remember the Indian connection with the railways. And another interlocutor said to me that we do this so that Tamils don't disappear from the history of Malaysia. And I would say at the end of the day, that's what really kept me going, because I felt I'd started this project and people had given me their time and shared their stories with me, both their life stories and the temple stories. And I just felt that I had a commitment to make sure that that became visible and was disseminated in some kind of a public space.